The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Glory, America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. It's Hugh Hewitt from France on my last day broadcasting from France with Generalissimo at my side, who has gone 100% native, as we will show you now. He's Pierre with his Evian and his mustache and his beret. He totally lost his mind. But he's been very helpful in getting us on the air, because it's actually kind of tricky to do this from a boat. And I really want to thank my guest co-host all week long, Ed Morrissey, who is in Texas. And Edward, we both want to thank you. You've been so patient all week long. You've got us on the air each time.
Even though you're unnecessary, you were a lot of fun to hang around. Yeah, exactly.
It was wonderful and super having you. So I'm not going to waste any more time thanking Adam and Ben and everybody else who made this happen, including Alma Waterways and Wayne, who's in the front row, and Amy and George, who's in the back row, and all the tribbles who are listening and encouraging us or throwing tomatoes, as the case may be. Let's go right to Joe Biden in the Roosevelt Room yesterday, because this is the rundown. We do want people to hear what the President of the United States had to say. Cut number two. This is the first amazing thing the President said yesterday.
I think what you're seeing is enormous growth in the country that was affected by everything from COVID and the COVID blockages that we occurred along the way.
So, Edward, the economy contracted by 1.4% on an annualized basis. So the president comes out and says, I think what you're seeing is enormous growth in the country, to which you respond.
We're not seeing it's neither enormous growth nor is it. This is almost Orwellian, you know, contraction is growth. And this isn't really a COVID-related issue. It is an export-import imbalance, which got really bad for some reason in Q1. We were having more COVID issues in Q4, and yet we managed to increase exports by, I think, 23% in Q4, and actually contracted 9.6% in Q1. That is really what did it, because the level of import increase was about the same between Q4 and Q1, around 23%. And you have to understand that exports boost GDP, imports subtract from GDP. So when you've got 37 point gap between the two, it's going to make your GDP look bad. Now, there is the other fundamentals didn't look bad. I mean, business investment dropped off a lot, but it was still up 2.3%. Consumer spending was up 2.5%. I mean, those aren't bad numbers, and I don't think that we need to hit the panic button on this, but I do wonder what the Fed's going to do after having seen this.
I'm praying we don't hit the panic button, because I think right now, if I had capital, I would be buying Apple and Amazon, both of which got slaughtered in the market yesterday. And I want to go down to the Financial Times. The two stories on Apple and Adam were that Apple executive warned it could sustain a hit of up to $8 billion in the current quarter. They're down a lot today. Amazon got even more slaughtered, recording its slowest ever revenue growth in the first quarter amid a drop of online retail sales and heavy costs. These are America's preeminent companies. If I had any nickel I've got, I'm buying these two on the dip today, because this is the nadir, I hope, because if it gets worse from here, it's going to be bad. But let's go back to the president. Cut number three in the Roosevelt Room yesterday.
Well, I'm not concerned about a recession. And I mean, you're always concerned about a recession, but the GDP, you know, fell to 1.4%. But here's the deal. We're also had last quarter consumer spending and business investment and residential investment.
Right there. Ed Morrissey, I'm going to play two more because we can't do them one at a time. We'll run out of time. I'm not concerned about a recession. Of course, you're always concerned about a recession. Cut number four.
This is just another reminder of the imperative for Europe and the world to move more and more of our power needs to clean energy. In the United States, we're doing that right now. Last year, we developed more solar, wind, and battery storage than any year in our history, enough to power 56 million American homes.
Brain, just cut it off, Ben. There's no sense listening. It's wandered off onto his clean energy talking point. Everybody in Ukraine is being shelled in Kyiv last night. Everybody in the world is worried about nuclear war. And I'm sure they're all talking about green energy in Ukraine. That's what they're worried about the most. One more cut, Ed, and then I'm going to have you summarize what that experience was yesterday. This is the worst, really maybe the worst Joe Biden cut of the last year and a half, cut number five.
In addition to this supplemental funding, I'm also sending to Congress a comprehensive package of that will enhance our underlying effort to accommodate the Russian oligarchs and make sure we take their ill-begotten gains. We're going to accommodate them. We're going to seize their yachts, their luxury homes, and other ill-begotten gains of Putin's kleptocracy and the guys who are the kleptocracies. But these are bad guys. This legislative package strengthens our law enforcement capabilities.
Ed Morrissey, I'm kind of speechless, and I wish the president had been. What do you say?
This is reading off a teleprompter. This isn't even a this is not even an extemporaneous response to a question. He's reading off a teleprompter and apparently got lost. I don't know what the word accommodate came in, because it's clearly the wrong word, and I understand why that threw him, but I mean, that's bad. It's hard to take this guy seriously when he can't get through a teleprompter. He's clearly being
a to run away. To quote Monty Python, run away. If something's wrong with the prompter and you've gone off script and something is screwed up and you know you're making a mistake, just the first rule will stop digging. Let's go over to Nancy Pelosi, who had her own press conference. These are people running our country. Cut number six.
Here's the thing. There are many aspects to this, but the price of gas and the price of oil have an impact on the price of many other things, including the price of food. So lowering cost at the pump, lowering cost at the kitchen table, that's what Democrats are about. And again, we're beginning down this path with...
Stop. Ed Morrissey laughed involuntarily. And so that wasn't in the script, Ed. You just laughed involuntarily. Listen to this. She keeps going. Cut number seven.
That check.
Do you think the public is blaming Democrats, or will continue
to blame Democrats? No, I don't think the public is blaming Democrats. I think they're blaming the oil companies. They will blame all of us if we don't do something about the fossil fuel industry.
But they won't take that out on your side on the midterms, even if you pass this bill and prices don't get back.
Why would we say that? I don't think what you're saying is making very much sense, frankly. I mean, in all fairness.
Okay, that was my involuntary laugh. Yeah. Ed Morrissey, that's the president. I got one more. We got time. Chuck Schumer, cut number eight.
Democrats are focused like a laser on developing and passing legislation to lower costs and improve Americans' daily lives. It is our top priority, and higher gas prices is the place where Americans feel it the most. We're pushing for legislation to lower the cost of putting food on the table, keep the cost of insulin affordable, help relieve supply chain crisis, increase competition through antitrust enforcement, all areas where Congress can take action to help the American people reduce prices. But passing legislation to fight higher gas prices at the pump is at the very top of our list.
Ed Morrissey, if you're in a burning building, and the Democrats are in a burning building, you run it and your leadership is the fire chief is Joe Biden, and his deputy fire chief is Nancy Pelosi, and the lieutenant commander is Chuck Schumer. Are you safe in that burning? I mean, the country is looking at these three. The house is on fire. The world is on fire. And these are the three people we've got.
I would be calling my insurance agents and telling him it's going to be a total loss. Please send the check now. The the idea that Democrats are somehow opposed to high gas prices is absolutely ludicrous. Progressives have been trying to jack up the price of gas for years because they want to have less consumption. So, and they also want the price of gas to go up high enough to where all of these subsidized green energy alternatives can be competitive with natural gas, with fossil fuels. And this is their, I mean, this is their dream scenario. Now that they're on the hook for it, though, all of a sudden they're, oh, no, we're all about low prices in the Democratic Party.
They're going to get wiped out.
What's the line out of Raiders of the Lost Ark? We have top men on it.
For the rundown today. There's nothing you can do except go onto Twitter and follow Ed Morrissey, follow Radio Blogger, and follow me. Once again, I've been proven my followers are rocketing up again. Did it happen to you too, Ed? Overnight, it goes up another significant number as somehow they're opening up the filters. So I want everybody in the Hugh Hewitt audience to realize that Twitter is back to actually allowing you to come and follow the people you hear on air. We will bring you the news. You can trust us, but you got to follow us on Twitter. You won't get blocked. You won't get muted. Just head to Hugh Hewitt on Twitter, Ed Morrissey on Twitter, Town Hall Review on Twitter, at Radio Blogger on Twitter, and do it today before they change their mind.
Sunset Boulevard, say goodbye to Hollywood.
Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt, Generalissimo at my side. I am in France. Ed Morrissey is standing by and co-hosting with me, so he may ask our official film critic of the Hugh Hewitt Show, Sonny Bunch, a question or two as well. Sonny, I have been in France for 2 weeks, and I have no idea what the news is from Hollywood in the screens and the theaters. And so I'm going to leave it to you to bring us up to date, and Ed can interrupt you, your monologue, if he has a question or a comment. But I have no idea what's happened or if I should care about anything.
Oh, well, that must be nice, just being able to unplug, get away to France for a bit. I envy that. So last week I had briefly mentioned the new Nick Cage movie, The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent, a sort of meta-comedy in which Nick Cage plays a character called Nick Cage. Nick N-I-C Cage plays N-I-C K Cage. Get it? It's slightly different. I had said that it was getting good reviews and people seem to like it, so I'm sure it's fine. I will be honest, I saw it last weekend after our chat, and I did not love it. I was not impressed by it. I am a big Nicolas Cage fan, as you know. I was very, very high on Pig, one of my favorite movies of last year. But this movie does not work for me. It did not work for me because it is just not – it is a very kind of straightforward studio comedy where all of the best jokes are in the trailer. Again, Nicolas Cage plays a character called Nick Cage. He is an actor who is has kind of diluted his brand by being in too many things, and he is offered $1 million to go to the birthday party for an international drug lord. He takes it. Turns out the CIA is onto this guy. They think he's kidnapped the daughter of some president somewhere, blah, blah, blah. It turns into this really bland action comedy. Did not love it. Do not recommend it. But I'm very much in the minority here. So it's one of the few movies I have reviewed negatively and have gotten a fair amount of pushback on Twitter. So, take me with a grain of salt. I may be just a little bit too snobby for this one, I guess, is what I'm hearing.
Hey, Sonny, I think when I saw the concept for this, I was thinking of it in terms of a Being John Malkovich type of thing, right? Which is very inventive. I'm not sure that I loved it, but it was different. It was unusual. John Malkovich was totally bought into it. He was probably the most fun. John Malkovich himself and his performance was probably the most fun I had with that. So what you're saying, though, is that this is not at all a Being John Malkovich type of experience.
Well, no. So it's interesting that you mentioned Being John Malkovich, because Being John Malkovich was made by Spike Jonze and Charlie Kaufman. And I love Being John Malkovich. Those two teamed up with Nicolas Cage to make a movie called Adaptation a few years later. Adaptation is about is basically about Charlie Kaufman's efforts to adapt Susan Orlean's book, The Orchid Thief, and it is very much a meta examination of the state of Hollywood and the tension between art and commerce and the worries an artist has about being a sellout in that world. And Cage plays both Charlie Kaufman and a fictional brother of Charlie Kaufman, a guy who doesn't exist, whose name is Donald Kaufman. And Donald Kaufman is this, like, hacky Hollywood sellout who, you know, just wants to make high-concept thrillers, right? Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent reminded me more of Adaptation. It reminded me of Adaptation, especially in the first 30 minutes or so of The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent, because it is there are moments in The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent that are actually very funny, especially in the early going. There is a clever kind of critique of Hollywood. All of that gets tossed overboard, and it becomes. Have you seen Adaptation, Ed?
Yes.
Okay, so you know in Adaptation how the kind of hacky brothers. Terrible Hollywood script is what Adaptation kind of turns into at the end. It becomes kind of an action adventure thriller type movie instead of a meta comedy. Well, that's what is happening in Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent, except it's not an ironic comment on the state of Hollywood. It's just a like here's a hacky action thriller comedy from Nick Cage playing Nick Cage. It's bad. I don't like it. It's like a bad version of Adaptation is what I'm trying to say. And I liked Adaptation a lot. I like Nick Cage a lot. I did not care for this movie. But again, I am very much in the minority. So, you know.
All right. Now, Sonny, I have a question. I'm coming back and both of my boys want me to go see The Northmen with them on Sunday. I'll have jet lag. Not bad. It's France. It's 6 hours. Not bad. But I recall dimly that you said something about it, but I can't remember whether you gave me a thumbs up or a thumbs down. So this is, I don't want to have you in a failure to warn by misremembering. What sayest Thunny Bunch about Northman?
Well, I gave it a mixed positive review. And, Hugh, I think you're going to have some issues with this because it is ultra-violent. It's a movie that is very much in love with its violence. I can't remember if it's ultra-violence you don't like or just scariness in terms of...
I don't like horror movies. I don't like screwing around with the occult.
Okay. Well, yeah, this doesn't have a lot of that. Though there are some witches. There's some Scandinavian witches. There is a little bit of, you know, witch play and that sort of stuff here. So I don't know. But no, it's not a horror movie exactly. It's just it's a very, very violent historical epic. I described it as art house Conan the Barbarian. I mean, it's an arty movie. It is a...
To fill in your blank, Sonny... Hugh Hewitt's view is that the devil's a serious business, but it's the Christian devil, and I don't really and the Judeo-Christian devil. I don't like horror movies, and I don't like occult movies, and the rest of this stuff. You know, pagan Norse gods, they don't bother me. The Marvel bad guys don't bother me. I just don't like horror movies that depend upon people getting in touch with poltergeist. You know, there's a very specific biblical injunction against that stuff.
Yeah, no, I don't think you have anything to worry about there. With this movie.
Yeah, violence doesn't bother me. I deal with Dwayne every day. So is there anything on reality TV that we have to deal with? Oh, the International Symbol for Water. Okay, go ahead.
Ooh, I don't know. You know what I've been really enjoying is the HBO Max series Tokyo Vice is really, really good. It is executive produced by Michael Mann. It stars Ansel Elgort as a American... who is a journalist. His name is Jake Adelstein. He's one of the, he's the first, Gaijin foreigner to work at this big Tokyo newspaper. And he is trying to uncover a plot that involves the Yakuza and their
Sonny, this raises a meta question, and I've got 3 minutes to ask you on it. My son loves this, and you like it. And I wonder, do you think there is a vast Grand Canyon in movie taste between boomers and those who came after us? I'm a late boomer, so I'm not like an ancient boomer. I'm a class of 1956 boomer. Do you think movie tastes are just dramatically different between your generation, Edward, and my generation?
Well, I do think, I mean, the younger generation always likes stuff a little bit differently than the older generation, right? Have you watched it? Are you not a fan?
No. No, but my son really wants me to. But, Yakuza, I thought, oh, gosh, another. Yeah, I like Pinky Blinders or Peaky Blinders, but another crime thing? Another one?
I mean, it's not, I don't think it's much like Peaky Blinders, really. I think it's more of a, it's not a super violent, you know, crime drama type show. It really is more of a thriller. It's a mixture of, you know, kind of the unraveling of a mystery via journalism, combined with the examination of an honor culture that is Japan. But it's also very much a travelogue, and I know you're a big fan of productions that transport you places. It really is like a journey through the back streets of Tokyo, not the big, you know, sights that everybody sees, but the
then
clubs,
I would like it.
Restaurants. It's great. It's also a great. It's just a great like food porn, watch porn, suit porn type show, right? Like it is a.
That's why I love Pig. To reference back, I loved Pig because I don't know Oregon at all or that culture, and I thought Pig took us into places, both the food world and the Portland world, that we would never have gone, but for the fact that movie existed.
Yeah, yeah, it's similar. I mean, it's obviously very different because Tokyo very different, the East very different, et cetera, but. Good show. I've liked it a lot. I think the whole thing is out now. I think the last episode came out yesterday. I wasn't able to see it, but the it's good, and I strongly recommend it. It's better. It's certainly better than the new Liam Neeson movie that is out right now, Memory, which is basically, you know how Liam Neeson is the king of the old man action movie. Well, now he's made an old man action movie where the old man has Alzheimer's. It's like the logical progression of the old man action movie. He just keeps getting older, and now he's mentally impaired.
His particular set of skills is reduced. So just really quickly, I watched The Mystery of Marilyn Manson on Netflix last night. This is a brand new documentary that dropped. Not sure if you've had a chance to see it. It's interesting. It's got some new stuff in it. It also sort of makes questionable use, I think, of reenactments of actual live audio. I'm curious as to what you're hearing about that. I'd certainly recommend it with some reservations.
I'm not a big fan of reenactments in documentaries. I don't like it. If you don't have the actual footage, just give me what the talking heads are saying. And if you just have audio, you know, that's a hard thing to overcome. But you just play it over stills or something. I don't like monkeying around with that sort of thing, especially if you're going to, you know, describe yourself as a documentary.
All right, last question, Sonny Bunch. You gave that a warm over. We're almost at that. Have you noticed, since the filters allegedly were gigged at Twitter, if the followers of Sonny Bunch, easy enough to remember, Sonny Bunch, have gone up, stayed the same, or gone down?
I would say that I would not say that I have like had a huge jump or anything. I've picked up some followers. I steadily pick up about 100 followers a week. I haven't seen much difference there. People obviously should be following me on Twitter at Sonny Bunch, but
Sonny Bunch, and they should be subscribed to your two podcasts, which are wonderful. Sonny Bunch, The Bulwark Goes to the Movie, and Across the Movie Aisle. Both of them are podcasts. You should subscribe. You should comment. And thank you, Sonny. And do you run a podcast? Do you have a podcast that we should have people subscribe to? What is it?
I do. It's the Ed Morrissey Show podcast. It drops on Tuesdays and Thursdays. You can subscribe at Spotify, iTunes, or Apple Podcasts, I'm sorry, YouTube. The Town Hall Media Player has it as well. You just go to hotair.com, click on Ed Morrissey Show at the top.
And it's like subscribe to the Hugh Hewitt Show, highly concentrated Hugh. Get it all in one place and just get it up every single day. Ed and I come back with Tarzana Joe, poet laureate of the Hugh Hewitt Show. It's immensely popular among the people who are traveling with me. Tarzana Joe at Reagan.com to get your poetry. Come right back. Joined now by the poet laureate of the Hugh Hewitt Show, Tarzana Joe. Joe, you're on with Ed Morrissey from France, and I've got to pay you the ultimate compliment. A number of listeners on the Hugh Cruise have gotten poems from you. And we sat around last night and we were all praising you with high praise and how you are actually America's poet laureate, not merely the poet laureate of the Hugh Hewitt Show.
No wonder my ears were burning last night. But it's a good thing. But as a poet, Hugh, I'm a contrarian.
It's a very good thing.
It is a great thing. When you say good morning, I say I have to think about it. So I'm, you know, I'm wondering if this, you know, what will this do to my ego? Not much. Okay.
Don't worry. There's no stinger. It's not a trick. There's no trap door. Just everyone was saying.
I was waiting for the anvil.
There's no trap door. Everyone was actually saying he's a great poet, and he did a great job at the reunion, the wedding. People were tearing up. They were talking about Tarzana Joe at Reagan.com and urging everyone else to buy a poem from Joe.
Don't worry, Joe. I wasn't one of the ones praising you.
Go ahead. Versify away, Joe. Now you've got the pressure on.
There's the tripwire. All right, here's the poem. I never drove a Tesla, though others have adored it, for the very simple reason that I never could afford it. And so I make my way from San Jose to San Jacinto in something more affordable, my old but trusty Pinto. Now, Elon and his companies are driving leftists crazy, although from where I'm sitting, his halo is a bit hazy. His modus operandi is strictly unconventional. His business models tend to be a wee bit existential. I marvel at the money into businesses he's funneling and feels as unrelatable as blasting off and tunneling. And now, with major liberals, he's strictly on the outs because of fortunes that he flaunts and protocols he flouts. I welcome his endeavors, but before I start the toasting, I have to be a skeptic because the proof is in the posting. It's been my inclination to be credulous and trusting, but knights in shining armor seem to have a way of seeing conservatives as happy as can be. But with so much more to happen, I just think I'll wait and see. That's Where's the Anvil by Tarzana Joe.
Joe, you know, I've got Ed on Skype, and I'm watching him, and I'm watching my live react. What word did he come up with, existentially?
Existential.
Existential. Now, existential. I don't know if you've ever seen, there's a play called The Upstart Crow about Shakespeare. It's a kind of British sitcom, and every time he says something that's not a word, they say, "Will, that's not a word." He says, "I'm a poet. I make up words." So that's my response to existential.
Okay. Well, I want to tell everyone that if you want a poet, we got new affiliates. Joe works for hire. He is a poet for hire. He's a hired gun who will rhyme for you for the right amount of money, and he's reasonable. You have to write him at TarzanaJoe@Reagan.com, TarzanaJoe@Reagan.com. All of his work is collected at TarzanaJoe.com, including today's poem. And I'm just astonished at how many people on this trip have had commissioned work by Tarzana Joe. I think 200 years hence, people are going to be collecting them and finding them in attics and say, "I found a Joe poem."
Well, there's one. My favorite poem I wrote was for a family that left the house that they had been living in, you know, through generations for like 80 years, and they left a poem about all the good things that happened in that house for the homeowners that came next. That was one of my favorite poems I've ever written. So, yeah, that might be in the attic someday.
That's it. Tarzana Joe, thank you, my friend. And I want to say as well, if you need a get well poem, I don't have a get well poem ready for our friend Tom, whose sister is along with us, Karen Liu. But Tom, I know you're home and resting well, and we wish you well. And I don't have a bell with which to sell some kind of get well tell. But nevertheless, if Joe was here, he could have done it. And Tarzana Joe has, you know, this started off as a frolic. Really? Joe called up the poem. How did it start off, Dwayne?
We were auditioning for a Shakespeare segment and ended up with David Allen White, and Joe was one of the guys that was auditioning for it. But we liked him because he was funny, and so we called him back and said, "So can you do poetry?" And he dropped a poem on us on the spot, and we said, "Hired."
And so all across the country, people have found it. Now we're in 15 years of it, 17 years. What year was that?
Oh, no, this was the first year of the show. Remember we did the fiction, the nonfiction?
Yeah, you're right.
That was back in
01. It's been more than 20 years that Tarzana Joe at Reagan.com, that's how you write to him, has been writing poems. And he charges you, obviously, a few hundred bucks, $100, depends on how long it is or how short a period of time. for retirements and weddings and going aways, but also get well poems. And I could get a poem for Ed Morrissey that would be a thank you poem because Ed has done such a wonderful job. Or we could send it to every general manager out there and say, Ed Morrissey ought to be your morning drive. Ed, if you could do any segment of the day as a talk show host, I've got this in my head that you ought to be. You're so good at this. What segment would you do? I've done every segment except 9 to noon East Coast time.
The right answer is not morning drive.
Not morning drive.
I was going to say either morning drive or afternoon drive because those are the two critical.
Afternoon drive would
periods.
Be terrific.
Yeah. I mean, afternoon drive would be great, but... you know, I'd be willing to do anything that anybody asked me to do, actually, at this point, Hugh. I mean, I just have to...
Hey, you're like Tarzana Joe. If you send Joe a request for a poem, he'll give you a reasonable rate. And if you need a radio host, call up Ed Morrissey. Come right back. In the meantime, go subscribe to The Universe if you've liked this unusual 2 weeks. We do something unusual every week. Go over to The Universe, subscribe. Go to Hugh Hewitt. Follow me on Twitter. Follow Ed at Ed Morrissey. Follow Radio Blogger. Thank you, Adam and Ben. We'll be right back. Hour number two of the Hugh Hewitt Show. Dave McCormick is coming up. Stay with us. I want to remind you that our sponsor is andrewandtodd.com. They're with Sierra Pacific. They lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-888-1172. Beyond the sea. Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt from France, and I've got Ed Morrissey in Texas standing by, Radio Blogger at my side, and we're joined, as that music suggests, by Admiral James Stavridis, retired United States Navy, former Allied Supreme Commander, and he, of course, also ran Southern Command. Admiral, Ed is standing by, and we'll be going back and forth with questions for you from me. I would like to get your assessment. The head of Ukraine, or the advisor to the president today, said Russia is suffering colossal losses in the east. Now, obviously, no one's going to say we're suffering colossal losses, but Ukraine has been pretty good in being objective about what is going on. How do you interpret that, Admiral?
I think it's entirely possible that the Russians are, in fact, continuing to be battered on the battlefield. And I think very reliably, Hugh, in the 2 months to date, about 15,000 Russians killed in action. And I can triangulate that between Ukrainian commentary, British intelligence, and U.S. intelligence. So to me, if they've lost 15,000 in the fight up north, essentially, I don't see that someone's going to wave a magic wand above the Russian army and suddenly it'll turn into this high-performing, low-casualty combat machine. So I think it's logical that there are high losses, whether they're colossal or big. I don't know, and I, for one, will wait until we hear from U.S. intelligence, British intelligence. That'll be coming shortly, but I'd say it's a good indicator for the Ukrainians.
And Admiral, before I throw it over to Ed, my second question to you is the inability of Russia to command the air. We've grown so used to that, watching in 91 with the invasion in Iraq, and in 2001, the expedition to Afghanistan, 2003, the invasion of Iraq. We secured air control. What has happened here? Why haven't the Russians been able to do that? And do they have it over eastern Ukraine right now as they begin their new offensive?
They certainly have more control over spaces where they have control on the ground. And so, yes, they have a higher degree of control in eastern Ukraine. The reason they have not established control across the entire country, I think, are threefold. One, it's a vast country. If you put a map of Ukraine on top of the northeastern United States, it runs from New York City to Chicago, from Raleigh, North Carolina, to Toronto, north of Detroit. It's a huge land space and therefore a huge airspace. Second point, the Russian inability to conduct effective logistics that we saw and continue to see on the ground. No reason to believe they're much better at doing it with their air forces. So secondly, I'm going to bet on bad logistics, bad maintenance. And then thirdly, and perhaps most importantly, again, the fighting spirit of the Ukrainians. into whose welcoming hands we have placed an awful lot of capability. So far, kind of low-level stingers up to 10, 12,000 feet. Watch when those S-300s come online, and if we give them additional combat aircraft, they're already flying their own to testing. If we up our game there, don't look, again, for any sudden change in the battlefield or in the air above it. Russia will continue to struggle there as well.
Admiral Stavridis, I mean, one of the issues that I see here is a sort of a replay of what happened in the north. And maybe even more surprisingly, in Donbas, you know, the Luhansk-Donetsk area, where Russia already had some strength. I would have expected the lines to move quickly down there with the Russian reinforcements and, frankly, much simpler logistics. Again, speaking about logistics, the lines of communication into that part of Ukraine are much simpler for Russia. And yet, from what I'm seeing, and maybe I'm not getting the up-to-date picture here, what I'm seeing is that the lines really aren't moving very fast down there. Does this suggest that they're running into the same problems that they had in the north? And how long can they keep pushing before the Ukrainians simply outlast them down there and start shredding whatever forward units get stuck?
First, your assessment is correct so far. I think we do need to give this new offensive kind of, if you will, invasion 2.0. Let's wait another week or so, because that's when we'll really be able to tell if the Russians have improved the points you correctly mentioned, Ed, notably the logistics. But here's I think, a very important additional point, which is that you can surge logistics, you can improve your tactics, but you can't surge leadership onto a battlefield. And thus far, we haven't seen a shred of leadership out of the part of the Russians. This is why Putin brought in General Nikolaev, the so-called butcher of Syria, hoping to inject some enthusiasm in his troops, which has been very lacking thus far. So even if they fix those kind of problems, I think we're going to see continued leadership challenges. And then finally, back to the question Hugh asked a minute ago, Ed, about control of the air. You know, it's not just controlling the airspace, it is combining effects. In other words, creating real synchronous activity, real symmetry between your air forces, your ground forces. That's what's been lacking. The U.S. military calls it combined arms. The Russians have shown little ability to execute that. So, bottom line, when I put all that together, I'd give it another week. But certainly the early indications are that there is not going to be a sudden, miraculous new Russian capability on display here.
Admiral Hugh again, we have seen the headlines that in Moldova there is this breakaway region, Transnistria, which you've probably been to since you've been to everywhere in the world, or you've been close to it. And I'm curious as to whether or not you think NATO ought to be doing to Moldova what I wish they had done vis-a-vis Ukraine 6 months ago, which is to begin to forward position supplies that Moldova will need if they become Putin's next target. I know that's three moves down the board, but ought we to be equipping Moldova to do what Ukraine has done? Is there enough time to do that?
Yes and yes. And a third yes would be, I have been to Moldova. I've been to the capital just now, and I've been around the country. I've been on the border, if you will. It's kind of a faux border between Moldova proper and this Transnistria, which is the breakaway segment that Russia is in control of. I think it would be prudent to increase level of NATO activity with Moldova. And when I was Supreme Allied Commander 8-9 years ago, we were doing so. We had a very partnership level relationship with Moldova as a general proposition. The Moldovans, who kind of look toward Romania as a partner nation, they have a lot of interconnected culture and history. It would be a good place for our Romanian NATO allies to put some more military activity, and as you suggest, you put some capability forward. Small country, small effort, but could pay big dividends in, again, sending a signal to Putin that not only are we going to defend every inch of the NATO border, but we're also going to work with real democracies to defend them against Russia.
Admiral, the Russians seem to be rattling the nuclear saber here more and more, at least rhetorically. Their domestic propaganda seems to be ramping up in that regard, too. Do Russians bluff? I mean, this is sort of like, it's almost like the Star Trek question. Do Vulcans bluff? Do Russians bluff in this regard? Or is this a signal that this is going to get, that this conflict is about to turn nuclear?
I don't think the conflict is about to turn nuclear. Russians bluff, all nations bluff who have nuclear weapons. And by the way, if you think about Putin, you know, he thinks he's Peter the Great expanding the borders of the Russian Empire. He's going to end up like Kim Jong-un, isolated, weakened, and sitting on a pile of nuclear weapons that, frankly, in the end, you can't really use with any utility. So I think it's highly unlikely Putin reaches, certainly for an apocalyptic nuclear attack on the West. I think that is not going to happen. Could he use a tactical nuclear weapon, Ed? I guess that's possible, but I think he is cognizant of the fact that right now, diplomatically, you've got the West and all the democracies, and you've got Putin and China, the real authoritarian nations. But there's a huge swing vote out there in the West. It's called Latin America and the Caribbean, Sub-Saharan Africa, South Asia. Today we see Indonesia, I think, not commendably inviting Putin to the G20. Putin is aware that if he uses a tactical nuclear weapon, he'll lose that enormous swing vote. It's 3 billion people in those countries who still haven't completely aligned. So, no, I don't think he'll reach for nuclear. I'll close by saying, if you want to go into the weapons of mass destruction question, a chemical weapon, I could see that. I hate to say it, but he's laid the groundwork there by accusing the Ukrainians of having chemical weapons, the U.S. of conducting research, all kinds of nonsense and lies as usual. But watch for him if he goes into WMD to use chemical. I don't see nuclear.
Now, I want to close, Admiral. Last question for you. I was at the beaches of Normandy with Dwayne 2 days past, and one of the things that stuck in my mind was the heroism, not everyone, of everyone involved, of the leaders, of the young lieutenants, of General McNerney, of General Roosevelt. But they also paid particular attention to the NCOs that America was blessed with on that day that kept the men moving towards the beaches. As you take that in mind, how has the Ukrainian NCO Corps performed in this? I know their leadership at the top has been excellent, but as you watch as a trained military observer of every aspect of a military leadership, has your eye fallen on their NCOs?
It has. And we NATO and the West have really had extraordinary impact as follows. The Russian model of war, of military, degrades the importance of the NCO Corps. It is all very officer-driven because they want highly centralized control of everything. They don't want to delegate. They don't want, if you will, free market combat where younger leaders are capable of moving out with their squad, with their platoon, under the leadership of a strong NCO. The U.S. and the Western model is precisely the opposite. The strongest thing the Navy has in its locker of leadership are chief petty officers, NCOs in this context. Here's the point. Starting in 2014, from that first invasion, NATO and the U.S. have been deeply involved in training and working with the Ukrainian armed forces. You can give them all the stingers in the world, but until they have a strong leadership model with strong NCOs, they don't win on the battlefield. So that's something
well said.
We did get ahead of the curve, and we're going to continue to do so. It is a distinct and important difference, and it's a real advantage to the Ukrainians.
Thank you, Admiral. As always, wonderful. Well put. Follow him at Twitter, Stavridis, @Stavridis. Thank you, Admiral. Welcome back, America. IBU Hewitt. Ed Morrissey is with me in Texas. We're joined by Pennsylvania Senate candidate David McCormick. And, David, I'm glad you joined us. This is fortuitous. I'm in Normandy. I was just at the beaches where the airborne came and made such an amazing contribution on D-Day. I know you're a veteran of the 82nd Airborne. I'm sure your chest swells a bit with pride when you read about it. But, boy, you can't stop but wonder what that jump was like. Do they teach you that in jump school, that you're going to end up like the guys did in the 82nd, the 101st that morning?
Well, those guys are our heroes. You know, if you go to Fort Bragg and go to all the different drop zones, they're all named after the different drop zones in Europe when the 82nd came in on D-Day. And those guys are heroes. They're an inspiration to us all, no doubt about it.
They really were. So, David, we're in the closing sprint. You're my last Pennsylvania Senate candidate to talk to before the voting is underway, I think, absentee. How does the campaign look to you, and what's your closing kick message before I turn it over to Ed?
You know, it feels good to me. It's going to be very close. The polling has Memenaz and I in a tie. And, you know, the 30% of the voters are undecided. And so the closing pitch for me is, listen, this is couldn't be more important. This is this race will determine what conservative goes to Washington to represent Pennsylvania, whether we have someone who can fight for the key issues that Pennsylvanians care about. And also someone who doesn't need on-the-job training. And so I'm presenting myself as a guy who's battle-tested in the military and combat, created jobs in Pennsylvania, and someone who's Pennsylvania true. Yeah, I grew up in Pennsylvania. I'm seventh-generation Pennsylvanian. And someone who's a real America First conservative. And I've put America First from the time I joined the Army at 18. And so that seems to be resonating. I had Mike Huckabee in yesterday. He came in and endorsed me, and we did a big meet and greet and a big rally at a VFW, and it was the best of America. It was a great day.
David, what's going to be the message about how you're the best candidate to beat the Democrats? Because obviously, I think when Republicans are going to be trooping to the polls here for the primary, they're going to be looking at Fetterman and saying, who's going to be the guy who's going to knock this guy off?
Well, listen, I mean, the thing with Fetterman and the Democrats in general, they're going to have to defend their ideas. And Fetterman's an avowed socialist. He is someone that has gone to a set of positions that are very outside the norm in Pennsylvania. And I'll go as an America First conservative, and whether it's the issue of the economy and a 40-year high in inflation, or whether it's energy policy, which has been a disaster under Joe Biden and the current governor, Governor Wolf, for Pennsylvanians, or whether it's the open border, which has led to a real fentanyl crisis in Pennsylvania, Fetterman will have to defend the policies he's representing, and he won't be able to do that. So the most important thing is to fight on ideas. And then profile-wise, listen, this is a guy who is a large man, a 6'8 guy with tattoos. He sort of looks like a badass and presents himself as such. And he's a guy that had a trust fund and went to Harvard. And I like the matchup of a guy who grew up in Pennsylvania, you know, baling hay on the farm and went to West Point and the 82nd Airborne and Ranger School and combat. And then went and created jobs as opposed to worked in the government his whole life. So that's the contrast that I would create on both ideas and leadership and the kind of leadership I can bring to Washington. The thing that's also obvious is that many Democrats in Pennsylvania are deeply concerned about the direction of the Democratic Party. So not only getting a great turnout for Republicans in the general, but those conservative Democrats, and you know, Hugh, there's lots of them in Pennsylvania, they're a real opportunity for me as well.
All right, last question, David McCormick. It's on my mind again. I don't want to embarrass you. You are the recipient of the Bronze Star for your role in 1991. And so I kind of incline towards people who do that. When you look back at the war in 1991 versus the war in 2003, ought we to have followed the model of 1991 when we invaded in 2003, which is do the job and get out?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that was that use of American power is very much in line with how I see America's role in the world, which is we walk softly but carry a big stick. When we go decisively. We go with the economic and military power of the United States, and we go on the side of American interests. And I think that that model of what happened in 1991 is the kind of model that I'd want to see us take our leadership in the world when I when I'm in the U.S. Senate. And as for the Bronze Star, listen, I'm really proud of my military service, but I never speak about it that way because you know you're right where the heroism happens. And so I'm always so proud to have served in our military. But there's so many brave men and women, and so many brave Americans that I never want to highlight that because there's so many I admire.
I know that, David, but I also know that the real heroes never tell you that they're heroes. So thank you for your service in the 82nd. Ed Morrissey, I can't talk to you. I'm going to go talk to Ed, to Larry Arnn. I want to thank you as well for just 2 weeks of wonderful service. Generalissimo, Adam, and Ben, thank you all. We will be back. I just want to make sure I remind everyone as well, go see 2,000 Mules. Salem Media executive produced that. They're going to profit from it if you go and see it. As will all my buddies on the air. I didn't have anything to do with making the movie, but they did, and they're all going to profit from it, and they're going to profit from having told the story of 2,000 Mules. No plug hole here, no hidden agenda here. We want you to watch that movie. Salem Media produced it. It's over at salemnow.com, and know that you go and should see it, and I'll see you on Monday.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.